Today's program has been brought to you by the Heritage Meat Shop, located in the historic Essex Street Market in New York City. For more information, visit heritagemeatshop.com. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Burning Down the House on heritageradionetwork.org. I'm Curtis B. Wayne, your weekly, almost weekly, fix of design, architecture, and the arts. Today, and I think it's especially appropriate, I want to speak with Charlotte Barnard, who's a design writer and critic, and also our inveterate veteran architect, Duo Dickinson. Are you there, Duo?
I am here.
Hey, cool. And Charlotte, say hello.
Hello, everyone. It's a pleasure to be here.
Yeah. Today, I'm glad that you both could join me on this rainy day. Is it raining out there in Madison, Connecticut, man?
It's always sunny in Madison.
Okay. Yeah, but I understand you live on a swamp or something, so.
It smells, but it's sunny.
Oh, that's biotics at work. Anyway, I wanted to talk about home. I wanted to start a conversation about what does home mean? What are the basic elements of home? If we might suppose that there's a basic human right to certain elements in one's place of habitation. Well, already, I'm making an assumption that habitation is a place. RV people might disagree with that. What might those elements be? What really makes a house a home? I don't want to get too much into the decorative aspects, unless decorative aspects are a fundamental element. If I might just step sideways for a moment. On Friday, I went out with the architect Leah Krieger and the mechanical designer Henry Gifford, and the three of us presented ourselves to the people out in Breezy Point in Queens, where not only did the storm surge lift many different houses, not even just the ones along the ocean, off of their foundations. We saw houses that had slid into each other and collapsed. But then also there was the catastrophic fire that was whipped by the winds. I had houses that were flooded and burning at the same time. And there are about 120 houses or homes that are burned down below their foundation lines. Pretty appalling. And we met with the chief, Martin Ingram, the chief of the Breezy Point Volunteer Fire Department. The firemen have become the expediters of reconstruction and recovery, which is really sort of wonderful. But it made me think even more so about home. Joe, let's take just a little break while we form some thoughts before we jump right in.
Take it to the end.
That was live from Heritage Radio Network of a couple weeks ago. So who wants to jump in first? I'm just asking the questions here. I'm not sure that I have any answers. I have my own predilections. Charlotte, Charlotte, tell us a little bit about your background.
Well, I've been a design journalist for about half of my journalism career. When I came to New York, I got into fashion and women's magazines. I worked at Vogue and Glamour, and also did a brief stint at Estee Lauder. And then I switched over to design and worked at House Beautiful, Martha Stewart Living, This Old House. And, you know, the notion of shelter continues to be obviously of great interest to me. When you were describing Hurricane Sandy's aftermath, got me to thinking about the idea of house, and for these people who've lost their homes, that house is an idea that they carry around right now in their memory and their heart, and that becomes completely personal. And so while a house is the structure, the home is what is uniquely yours, isn't it? It can be decorating or possessions.
Well, perhaps. I don't know. The word home is fraught with, at least in an American context, and that's the context that I know. Home is sort of an aspirational word. It has class associations. America is not a classless society. I heard you coughing, Duo.
No, I was just about to jump in and be rude as I usually am, but I think that the house as a word or a concept is uniquely trifurcated. I think of it as, in terms of building types, it is the most basic generic building you could think of. It is a function that every living human can understand because they live it every day, and every single person on this planet has a place that has the base reality of shelter as part of as people's survival. Secondly, you know, houses in America anyway, and I think throughout the world, are almost directly imprinted by the occupants themselves. Each house for each person means something slightly different. And then the third aspect is something you just touched on, Curtis, which is the fact that homes are also a cultural reality. And I think I have many European friends who are kind of aghast and amazed that Americans would have the temerity to value an individual plot of land with a freestanding house on it so much that they would have those houses in places where they can be, you know, launched into other houses by weather. And that idea of personal expression in an individual house with its own land is something which is, I think, mostly American and really, has a quality about it which I think Dolores Hayden's talked about in her books and any number of people have said has got an interesting twist on it because it's imprinted by our culture.
Hmm. Well, you've got a couple different thoughts there in that one long thought stream. The houses that were clearly lifted right off of their pilings and then slid on the wave into each other were not because of necessarily where they were, but because the people who constructed them were sloppy. I mean, they had no tie downs. We saw houses that had sat on pretty good foundations that still got lifted off because there weren't sufficient anchor bolts. When you're that near to the ocean, you have to think about hurricane-proof construction. And for the houses that were destroyed in that fashion, well, somebody was sloppy, which is unfortunate.
Were these houses that were built after a certain time?
Oh, they were. Most of these houses were built within the last 70 years. Now, in the case of Breezy Point, you know, they call it the Irish Riviera. Breezy Point has the second highest Irish American constituency in the United States after Quincy, Mass. So these were summertime bungalows in many cases. So they were done on the cheap. But then there are people who have lived there all year round for generations. And those houses are also bungalows. A pretty standard size is about 16 to 20 feet wide and 40 to 50 feet long. And it's an interesting sort of typology of house, but they become home with the addition of outdoor decks, which I think is an element that we could talk about later on. I myself feel that some sort of, for want of a better word, event, some sort of element that allows the dwellers contact with the out-of-doors, I think is should be a basic fundamental human right. And I it could be as something as simple as what you would see, say, in Paris, where there are full-height windows, French, we would call them French doors, but for them, they're windows that open inward with a railing so that you can step to the facade and you can stick your head out and you can see what the weather is, something that an ordinary window really doesn't allow you in most cases, except in very old houses where you might have a very large sash and you could, in fact, you know, hang out the window and call to your friends on the street. But that's a different kind of social interaction with your neighborhood than most recent houses permit you to do.
It, Americans are so privacy oriented, aren't they? I remember growing up and my mother lamenting the fact that, except for me riding my bicycle down the street, she said they wouldn't see any neighbors, you know, because everybody was so focused on their backyard and their patio and their deck and so forth. And, you know, and it is a symptom, isn't it, of everybody having their own plot of land and possibly a fence around it. And
yeah,
it
is unfortunate. I think what you're speaking to is the demise of the American porch.
Yes.
Now, in the little town in eastern Indiana, where my grandmother grew up, and I spent many summers as a boy, the old folks would sit on the porch, and people would just walk past, and you would engage them in conversation. Sometimes people would just pass by with the intention of stopping by to chat, and so they'd invite you in and get some lemonade, and they'd sit and they'd talk until it was dark, and they'd keep talking in the dark, and it was the most natural thing, and it was a wonderful learning experience for us kids to be able to hear how it is that the older folks talk to each other and what they talk to each other about and what their ideas were.
And they were looking out for you too.
They were.
Yeah. You could make the case that you know, in terms of anything that human beings create, the homes are the most reflective and most reactive to their makers. And I think you could make a fairly good case that the demise of the porch has everything to do with the ascendance of the television set and now the home computer and smartphones.
Yes.
And you could probably also make a case that with the trajectory of these missile houses launching into other houses, you could make a direct correlation between freedom and safety as a seesaw paradigm, where one person's freedom to build a house where he wants, how he wants, the way he wants, is in direct conflict with another person's right to have a safe place to live and therefore not have that house smash into your house. And that's why the regulations have more than quintupled in page number since 1970. And we are kind of in the middle of the most heavily regulated house building environment in the history of America anyway, and maybe the world.
Which is not necessarily so bad. If, for example, it was a little bit easier to actually find something in the International Building Code, which...
Right.
Almost every jurisdiction now has adopted one or, you know, a flavor of the IBC, which I guess was an outgrowth of the BOCA code.
Correct. Yep.
But
we use IBC every day here now, every day.
Yeah. Well, and I mean, if you're lucky, you have a searchable PDF version.
Yep.
and you can do keyword searches and find where something is obscurely stated. But it requires a mastery. But let's get back to the, I mean, you know, that's just our everyday day in, day out, quotidian pain in the neck aspect of being a residential architect. So let's talk about the elements. Now, Duo, you said, you know, that home is a reflection of the maker. Well, most homes are not actually made for people. They're a product. And they're self-financed by the builders.
Well, it's really fascinating about it, and I think I think Charlotte could back me up on this. What keeps shelter magazines, you know, living, although maybe not living quite as elegantly as they did 5 years ago, is the fact that no matter what happens, people want to take the blankest of builder boxes and make them theirs. And that's usually in the realm of decoration or addition or even sometimes subtraction. But almost no one leaves a home the way they buy it. They almost always personalize it. It's almost instinctive. And I think that's why even in recessions, you know, remodeling is a relatively active part of the building environment.
And I think there's a tension, too, between, absolutely agree that people want to make whatever space in theirs and put their imprint on it. But there's also a hesitation, as you were saying, that they'll take what the builder has made available to them and make some modifications, but there's still a tendency toward the white kitchen, mm-hmm. toward certain types of safe surface materials and so forth. And what I have heard as a journalist, and I think you've heard also, is that people don't want to make too many changes because they're concerned about resale value. And I remember my father saying to me when I was buying my co-op, he said, you know, there was a time when people just lived in their houses and they didn't think about selling them and making a profit or flipping them.
Yeah.
And so we're coming back to that, by the way. That cycle's coming around.
Yeah, and if you're going to do something to your kitchen, for example, why not make it the way that you want it instead of trying to guess what somebody in the future is going to find attractive, when in fact the cycle that we've just come through was that people they'd say, yeah, okay, it's a new kitchen, but I don't care because I'm going to rip it all out anyway.
Right.
And impose my own ethos on this kitchen. And similarly, you know, with bathrooms and closet space, although, you know, people don't redo. I don't know. What do you think? Do people redo their closets much?
Well, what is really fascinating to me is how, on the one hand, you can have something as fundamental and basic as your home, where you live, your largest set of clothing. It's this really central part of your physical world. And at the same time, to have its identity completely inverted for many people in the last 5 years since the recession happened, where 4 out of 5 people said to me when they would come to me for renovation or even building a new house, they would say, well, I want to do this, but how does that relate to resale? Because the idea was that no one thought they would live in their homes for more than a decade, that they would always flip them, they'd always make money. They were a fungible asset like a CD. Now, 1 in 5 says to me, what about resale? They say, I'm going to be here forever. I'm never going to sell this because I'll never get out of it what I think I could. So I'm going to spend less money, but I'm going to do whatever the hell I want and have it done the right way. And that paradigm shift happened for, you know, more than half of the people that come to talk to me as an architect in about a 2-year period. And that's, to me, I don't think many things change that quickly. I think that, you know, automobiles as another paradigm, I don't think we decided to do minivans that quickly, and I don't think we have decided to do hybrids that quickly. There seems to be this amazing change because our homes are so important to us, we want to get it right, and that means that we oftentimes have to completely shift our perspectives to maintain control.
Hmm.
Boy, that's really food for thought. We're both pausing.
Yeah, I'm not afraid of. I'm not afraid of dead space. This is not commercial radio. We don't have to keep talking, even though we have nothing to say.
You both have tons to say.
Yeah. Well, so what are people asking for these days? What?
You hit the nail on the head, Curtis, because the number one gigantic freaking trend is that people want to connect the inside of their house to the outside of their house. That often means connecting parts of the inside to other parts of the inside so they can connect that then to the outside. So we tend to take walls down. We tend to open up walls. We tend to make additions that are at ground level, that step down to the ground, that have openings that permeate through visually or physically. So the idea of getting connected to this patch of earth or the environment is almost become the prime directive. And that really has been an evolutionary ever since I started doing this over 30 years ago. But it's accelerated, I think, since people are focusing their eyeballs on these computer screens with such, you know, extreme intensity. They want to break that that addiction and not have a virtually real world, but a really real world to recharge in.
Uh-huh. Well, there are those who have studied this world, and they call it biophilia.
Mm, yeah, you're right.
And there is at least one study of which I'm aware that has, and I put this in quotes, proven that in an office space, if people have some sort of visual contact with a natural or landscape element, could be the sky, although they tend to gravitate towards vegetative conditions, that people are healthier, they take fewer sick days, they're happier, therefore they're more productive. And this was mostly based on a study of hospital stay lengths and hospitals that had green spaces that were adjacent to recovery rooms for post-surgical patients, I believe.
And I think it's so important that the home offer that, because Americans' work life now is such that not only are the hours longer, but who gets away for lunch now?
Right. I mean, yep.
Once upon a time, you might get into your car and go to lunch with a client. You might step outside at least to, when I was starting out, I worked in the Bay Area in California, and offices were proud to have that outside dining space because the weather was good almost the entire year round. And but you can't break away from your desk now. You can't break away from your computer. And even if you are walking down the street, you're probably checking your messages on your BlackBerry.
Sure. I think it's seen as sort of decadent that you leave your desk at lunch. You have people, I think falsely, actually, believing that if they're seen eating at their desk, it shows that they're diligent. That's not necessarily universal all over the world. I was talking with a friend who's working in Hong Kong just the other night. It was 11 o'clock at New York time, and it was noon the next day in Hong Kong, which is a little weird. But he's working in a design studio that encourages people to get up, walk around. They have an espresso bar. They've got a foosball table. They have an outdoor eating area, and they don't want people just sitting there staring at their computer screens all day long, because they don't believe that that is in fact productive, and it's certainly not creative. Well, now that's a pretty enlightened set of bosses, I think.
Yeah,
but I think it's even worse than you're saying, Curtis. I find that our clientele, the people that are typically I'd say feeling energized to take control of their domestic life by renovating their house or building a new house, those people are also, their minds are working in ways that now you never leave work. If you have a smartphone, you are basically got one part of who you are tethered to work basically every minute of every day. And I think it's created an enormous strain in homes, where we're finding more and more people that used to have a TV in every room are now having a television set in one room and specifically saying no TVs in this other parts of the house. Now, that TV in the one room is a fabulous, you know, 50-inch or 60-inch television set, which has got virtually a, you know, looks real when you see it. But they, I think, whereas before we would even do little TVs in bathrooms for people, really the TV is leaving the leaving half the bedrooms we're doing and half of the formal living rooms, and it's become, there's a TV place,
mm-hmm.
but there aren't TVs everywhere, because I think people are beginning to get sick of it, and they're beginning to want to have escape rooms. You know, they want to have a place where you're not bombarded.
Interesting. I was just looking at renovations for a friend of mine whose house actually was flooded out on Eastern Long Island. And I proposed to them that they create a TV nook for the purpose of watching TV, because they've got a young child. And the TV nook was much smaller than the play area for the little girl.
Mm.
And they were totally fine with that.
Yeah.
And I thought, wow. Yeah. I just put it out there to see what would happen. And they said, oh, that's great. That's fine. Matter of fact, we don't want to hang the TV set over the fireplace, because if we're sitting by the fireplace, we want to be watching the fire and talking to each other. We don't want to be distracted by the big picture frame video thing hanging over the fireplace. And I thought, well, this is very enlightened.
Do you both feel then that the great room, which I think came back about, well, I say came back because, you know, its origins are traced back to, what, the 18th century, you know, when
oh, yeah.
family lived communally in one room because there was one room. And I think it was around 1995 that it started to reemerge again because the families were so splintered during the day, off with the various activities, both parents working, the kids at sports activities, and it was the room where they could all come back together, and even if they were engaged in separate activities, they were all at least in the same room. Do you think this means there's a renaissance for its real intention, which was to bring a family together?
Actually, I think it's completely flipped around again, because we used to do those continually, and they used to have be glass filled and double height or very tall, and used to have five or six functions happening with no walls. It was sort of like the open classroom revolution of the 50s and 60s, which turned out to be a disaster. And most great rooms have really turned out to be a disaster, both in terms of being too hot or too cold or leaking or all these bad things, but the sound pollution that you get is insane. And what we find is that spaces are becoming subdividable, meaning they do have doors and things that can shut sound off or shut visual stuff off. What they also have done is, and we're doing this more and more, and this is kind of new, it's about 5 or 6 years old, we're finding that people are putting soft, comfortable furniture directly into or adjacent to kitchens. So that instead of like having a seating area that's 15 feet away in a great room that faces a TV and or a fireplace, you actually have soft, comfortable furniture that faces the cook. And it makes things more at a human scale. It's almost coming back to the scale that I think is you could ascribe to being, quote, normal, close quote, versus pretentious and trying to convince yourself that you're king of the world and that you're rich now because you've got a great room that's 30 feet by 40 feet and has got, you know, a huge table, a giant TV, and, you know, a kitchen with two islands in it. I think that has seemingly ebbed from our client request list.
That's good. I found great rooms always to be somewhat alien. I don't understand the urge that some people have to create an interior landscape of a huge amount of space. For me, the sort of the original source great room would be the double cube room at Wilton House. You know that house in Wiltshire?
Mm-hmm.
If you remember the Stanley Kubrick movie Barry Lyndon, a lot of
yes.
the scenes were set at Wilton House.
Oh, of course.
They have the Inigo Jones Folly Bridge there, you know.
Yep.
But that double cube house room in that house, well, I suppose that the aristocratic family that or fellow that had that designed did so simply because he could afford to do it. I mean, it's a huge space. It is two cubes, and the cube dimension has got to be 40 feet. So it's 40 feet by 80 feet by 40 feet high, and it has huge paintings.
You know? Yeah.
And if, so if you're going to have a room like that, then you have to have a 30-foot high painting. That's, I don't know, the Duke of Marlborough whipping the French or something. I don't know. But in an American setting, there's nothing you can do with the great space, with that excessive height, other than, you know, when you sit down on your sofa, you're 20 inches off the floor and you've got 10, 12 feet above you. What good is that unless you happen to have inherited a Calder mobile or something like that that's hanging, that, you know. If you have a chandelier in the space or any sort of pendant fixtures, you can't even relamp it without... Mm-hmm. Extraordinary measures. I mean, mm-hmm. It's just a ridiculous thing, and I don't know where it came from, other than possibly a misunderstanding of the double height space that comes out of a misunderstanding of Corbeau. Because prior to that, I hadn't had double height spaces in the American vernacular. It's really not part of the. It's not part of the 18th century house. It's really not part of the 19th century house. Even the grand houses in Newport, where they have their ballrooms, of course. But that's a ballroom. That's a fancy dress party, and you dance.
I think you hit on something, though, because when you started to see those types of indoor environments, it was in the 80s, wasn't it, when Americans were really starting to travel, and I think they probably went to Ireland and went to some manor and came back and said, oh, I like the way that soaring ceiling made me feel, and I certainly noticed, I think the luxury bathroom, the master suite, can be attributed to the takeoff of the spa culture and travel as well. People either go to spas in Italy, or
I take it a little bit more psychobabble-ish than that, in that I do think that as you know, an ascendant middle class finds itself has equity in homes that available beyond their wildest dreams when they purchase a house, and they see that there's this large potential uptick in their net worth, and they want to use that to fulfill something. I think they have this sort of interesting schizophrenic view of their homes. You see this all the time, where they want to have something which is very safe, as you were talking about, Charlotte, very safe, but at the same time fully expressive of who they are and their aspirations. So a very funny architect friend of mine, Jonathan Wagner of Wagner Beinfield, his father was the editor of Architectural Record for a while, said to me that his firm at the time did what he called contempolonials. They are contemporary and open on the inside and colonial and tweedy on the outside.
Huh.
And I think that what you would have with a great room was often part of obviously a new house design because it was just part of the deal, but you'd often see these things grafted onto classic, you know, prototypes like ranch houses or capes, where this large-scale space gained this enormous sex appeal because it was so distinct and so free and open and such a shock compared to the highly circumscribed, you know, very pent-up spaces that were often designed on historical prototypes around the ability of a fireplace to give you radiant heat.
Mm.
So I think of it as being kind of a conflicted internal psychological war that goes on in homeowners to either express or protect, and it's always kind of in between.
I personally take issue with houses like your buddy. I know those houses very well because, as you know, I lived in Rowayton and Darien for almost 20 years, And they're the guys who go and stick gratuitous cupolas on top of houses and think that it's cute when, in fact, the cupola doesn't do anything. It's just...
Right, exactly.
It's just up there. If I stick a cupola on a building, which I've only done twice, I made it do something. Either it brought in light or it let out heat.
Or both.
Or both. Cupolas are very good for bringing light into the center of a big building, and we were able to do that to great effect in one particular building that I'm rather pleased with. But see, what I don't understand is the desire for a home with big rooms. Big rooms make me feel small. I would rather have a whole chain of 10 by 10 rooms enfilade, and you would go from one to the next so that you can get away from each other and the family and still be nearby. And this is one of the things that I did want to talk about, which is what's wrong with the American living room. Joe, could we just have another little musical break while I catch my breath? You've just tuned in. This is Burning Down the House on Heritage Radio Network. I'm Curtis B. Wayne, talking about home with Charlotte Barnard, who is a design writer, and Duo Dickinson, who is an architect and a residential architect. I myself, I'll take any kind of job you want to give me. I'm Curtis B. Wayne, and you can find me in New York City. What's wrong with the American living room? I could rattle on for hours of what's wrong with the American living room, but I'd rather hear what you people have to say. Duo, you go.
Well, the thing which really is, I think, bizarre about especially the American living room in the past was that it was a place that had all of the pretense of your double cube room, or is this gigantic, highly formal place, and yet none of the flexibility of a truly open, bizarrely social space. It is sort of strangled by its furniture and incredibly frustrated by its window openings, and doesn't allow the kind of flexibility and reverie that you get in its sort of immediate replacement, which was the great room where you can move stuff around and have a lot of stuff go on. At the same time, makes you feel like you have to sit down and be very careful and cautious and quiet just because of the word formal living room. The good news is that I think that in my practice, even in the most expensive things we ever do, two things are disappearing. One is the formal living room, and the other is the master bathtub, where essentially things that are put on by rote because they quote-unquote should be there in a home are falling victim to the fact that people know that homes now, I think more than ever, are with you for a very long time, and so you better love them. And I am hard-pressed to think of a single client that loves a master bedroom bathroom, with a rare exception, and we do have them. But almost no one wants to have your mother's, you know, plastic-clad, upholstered, sofa'd living room, where you weren't supposed to sit down and you weren't supposed to be there. You're supposed to look at it and get out. It's a very strange vestige of bourgeois attempts at being upper middle class versus middle class. And it seems to me to be just a misfit. Doesn't work.
Gee, Duo, you're starting to sound like a Marxist.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
And it came along post-war, didn't it? Because before then, it was the parlor.
Yes, right.
Or there was the drawing room. And,
correct.
And I think you've both hit on something important here about how to fix it. Not that we need this extra room if we have a great room and we have, as Curtis was recommending, smaller rooms on Philad. I think a way to fix it is to change the size so that it's smaller and more intimate, or so that it's larger and you have an opportunity for multiple seating arrangements. Curtis and I were talking recently about living rooms, and I was telling him that one of my favorite living environments is River House in New York City, and I was in the drawing room of a friend's place at River House a couple of years ago, and aside from the fact that the environment was glamorous, you could take what was essentially there in that space and recreate it anywhere. It had beautiful proportions, it was long and deep, and it had the windows that Curtis described that mirror the human form, that are tall and that opened out, in this case onto the East River, but it could open on to a yard or patio, and there were at least three seating arrangements. You didn't have a sofa and two chairs surrounding a coffee table where everybody was forced to look at each other. These seating arrangements encouraged flow and conversation, and someone could even be in the room sitting by themselves reading a book or smoking a cigarette and feel natural and not awkward.
God, how risque of you that someone would smoke a cigarette indoors. I mean...
I think it still happens at River House.
It happens at my house. It's very funny, Duo, the description you made of the kitchen having sofas describes my one-bedroom apartment in New York. Yeah. I don't have a choice because my kitchen is an alcove, and so the table is for prep. It's for eating.
Yep.
It's for projects, and a sofa faces it. And
I have to say, human beings are very strange. We kind of do this. We have this innate desire to pig out, and at the same time, we always regret the stomach ache or the hangover afterward. And yet, reform is hard to do when you really want to have fun and express yourself. Until I think truth sort of rears its ugly head, and I think when you have a huge recession like we just did and are in the middle of, really. When you have a huge recession, or you've got a natural disaster like this, like Sandy, all the sort of follies of pretense tend to be made very evident to people, and we're finding that our average house size that we're doing has shrunk. We find that more people are renovating versus adding on, and we find that more and more people are doing what they did in every single one of the three other recessions that I've been involved with over the last 35 years. Is that they're thinking if they really hate the house that they're in or purchasing, they're saying, can I save some of it and really, maybe add on or maybe demolish some, but can I save some of it? And 5 years ago, the first words out of their mouths when they would come to my office with a fairly clunky house was, it's a teardown. And now the word teardown just simply has kind of gone away, and people are seeing the virtues in things like using a table for projects and eating and food prep. Like you just said, as opposed to having one separate table or even room for each one of those things.
Yeah, well, that has led me to think very seriously about what are the elements of habitation? What do you really need, for example, to make a kitchen? Well, you can have a kitchen by the side of the road if you watch Tony Bourdain's show. Reservations. He goes to places like Vietnam or Thailand, and they're cooking in the street. That's still a kitchen. So they have some place to prepare the ingredients. They have some way of containing the ingredients until they do the cooking, and they have some sort of cooking system. Usually it's just an open fire on the ground. And they have utensils, so they have to have a place to... keep the utensils, and they have to have some way to clean up the kitchen when they're done, which could just be two pails of water, one that's warm and soapy and the other one that's boiling so that you can scald it.
Mm.
And that's a kitchen. Do you need yards and yards of granite countertop? Well, not really. Do you need three ovens? No, you don't, unless you're going to be doing catering. Do you need a warming drawer? Not really. Not unless you're throwing a big party. And how often does that come along? Do you need a wine cave that's refrigerated that stays at 55 degrees? Not really. Not if you have... not if your dwelling is... And I hate to use architecty words, but not if your habitation is in a conurbation, where there's a wine shop and they hold on to it for you. Do you need to be collecting dozens and dozens of bottles of wine? Well, not really. Again, that's a middle class affectation, pretending to be like the lord of the manor with a wine cellar. Similarly, what does a dwelling need in terms of a sleeping arrangement? I'm thinking of Monticello, where Mr. Jefferson put his bed in the thickness of a wall.
Yep.
And his bedroom was really his study. So he was sleeping in an alcove, which was open to two different rooms. And where was bedroom? Well, there was no bedroom. It was a bed space adjacent to a dressing room, a writing room. Back to the living room. I think that the number one thing that's wrong with the American living room is that... well, it's the place where you are when you're not either in the kitchen or in your bedroom sleeping or whatever you do in your bedroom or in the bathroom. And one of the and I've observed this. It's happened to me, and I've seen it happen with other people. When you're a kid, if your family is of a certain economic status, you'll have your own room. So you can be in your own room by yourself. You can be doing your homework. You can be doing your stuff. You could be, whatever you're doing as a kid. However, when you're part of a couple, you're sharing a bedroom. And if you come home from work and you've had a hard day, what then happens next is you sack out in front of the TV set and zone out. And then anybody who comes into that space who might actually want to talk to you is likely to misunderstand that you're angry with them, when in fact you just want to be alone because you don't have your own room. I think everyone has a basic human right to have their own room, at least an 8x10 room that's your room. Now, in our family, historically, the old folks, grandfather had his study, the other grandfather had his shop. The grandmothers had their rooms. They had a sewing corner.
That's right.
And so you could go and I'm here doing my thing. And so then you don't even have to say, leave me alone, because it's understood.
My father had his workbench and my mother had the sewing room.
Yep.
It was good for their marriage.
Absolutely.
Twin sinks was good for their marriage too. And the bathroom.
Yeah, right. It doesn't have to be a grand bathroom just to have two different sinks, because
your own space.
You got different stuff, you know.
I think human beings have this have a real confusion between a control and the expression of being in control. In other words, separate sinks is terrific. I think having a place. My father had a desk where he sorted out his stamp collection. My mom basically had a sewing room in the attic, and I think those represented these small levels of their own personal space and control, where they could be with themselves and do what they wanted to do, and they felt like the space embraced them and that they were really at one with this little place. I think that gets bizarrely transmuted in sort of popular culture into having, a gigantic media room, or having an indoor golf simulator, or having a walk-in cave for wine with a tasting table in it in a house. And this isn't; these are not affects of the super rich. These are clients of mine that think that they will feel better about themselves if they can have this fantasy space versus creating a space for how they live now with their stamp collection, with their sewing machine that they have now. And part of my job as Joe Architect is to sort of say, well, how do you live now, and how can where you live reflect how you live now versus create the context for a fantasy life that you might not really like once you have the accommodation for it.
I'm listening. I was turning up Charlotte's volume on her phones. She was in such rapt attention at what you were saying, but then I realized that she just couldn't hear.
There we go. Well, I'm infinitely unlistenable. It's true.
Not true.
No, I totally agree with what you've just said. That it's a confusing plurality of notions of, well, I must have this and I must have that. It's like that one really fabulous scene in Mr. Blandings Builds His Dream House.
Yes.
Where the Blandings are there with their terribly nice New England architect, you know, and he's got his tweed jacket and he's got his pipe. And they start scribbling all over the plan. Well, I need a sewing room, then the children's playroom. And it's like, well, and then, you know, he's exasperated because, of course, they can't afford all of that.
Yeah, yeah.
But they've just created a program for a house that's three times larger.
Yep. Well, I think it is the classic human condition where our grasp always is inadequate for our reach. We want stuff that we can't have, and so we keep evolving and trying to make things better. The problem is with a house, the risks are enormous. I mean, if you overspend on a car, maybe you've blown $5,000. If you overspend on a house, you overspend by $100,000 or $200,000 or $300,000, and this becomes this enormous risk, which is now writ large for everybody in America. And I do think that by having this disastrous economic setback caused by the lack of value in the American home, I think it's a healthy reorganization of what our priorities are in terms of how we live and where we live.
Yeah, we've gone from owning the house to the house owning us, haven't we?
Exactly right.
Yeah.
Exactly right.
Or in my case, the rent owns me.
Right. Right. And, you know, Curtis, that is something who am I to tell you what to do on your radio show? But what I find amazing is that very few people have given, I think, the appropriate attention to how somebody who decides not to own where they live for a lot of good reasons, to rent where they live, how they can control that environment in ways that aren't just about decoration, but in terms of inhabitation. And the New York Times has some beautiful stories about that, many that are really interesting. But I don't think, I think Charlotte could back me up on this, I don't think the mainstream residential architecture press deals much beyond ownership properties.
Yeah, you're right. And, well, there is the blog apartment.
Yes.
Apartment Therapy,
mm-hmm. which I do love. I think that is wonderful,
and that's a great thing. But here's the thing: for those of us who write about shelter, and those of us who are architects and creating shelter, of course, collaboratively with our clients, there's a wonderful opportunity for some education here. The big theme when I was in architecture school was multi-purpose space.
Mm. Yep.
Because we were looking at the world from a position of, as compared to previous decades, relative impoverishment. And so spaces had to do more than one thing. To me, an architectural response to that was the fat wall. That is, a wall that actually might contain spaces within it, like Mr. Jefferson's bed inside the wall, which also then comes from a Gestalt idea that Aldo van Dijk had of as you're penetrating through the wall, a wall not being a plane but actually a mass. And then you see that in, say, in Portuguese architecture, where the wall has so much thickness that they've carved out a place to sit by the window and read. And I find that very fascinating.
Mm.
So you might have a play of small spaces and large spaces. And to me, there's nothing more wonderful than a closet that's big enough that you can just lock yourself in there and do whatever, you know, read your books. A lot of voiceover people actually do their work in their in their wardrobes. Because who's got a decent soundproof studio? Not like Heritage Radio Network, where always you hear the festivities of Roberta's in the background, all the din of all the happiness going on here. To me, what the number one thing that's wrong with the American living room is that the furniture is almost always pushed up against the walls.
Yeah, yeah.
I never saw a wall from ceiling to floor without something up against it until I was into my 20s and had my own apartment, and I didn't have enough money for furniture. And so I had a whole 30-foot long wall, and it was 12 feet high, and I didn't even want to put anything on the wall because I just wanted to see the wall. But then, you know, I was in architecture school, so I was seeing it from a different sort of filter or prism. But I don't understand what it is about American culture that people feel that they have to populate a room by shoving furniture up against the wall. If you look at an 18th century room, if you go to the Met in New York, you see the period rooms. The furniture is in the center of the room.
Yeah.
And you see the walls because in many of those cases, the fancier ones, the walls are decorated. And you wouldn't want to put something up in front of it because it would spoil the decorative effect.
Yeah. Yeah, I guess it is a symptom of, I hadn't thought of that, of the opportunity to put things on the wall. And again, the ascendance of the television set, you know, which had to be against the wall because it was plugged into an outlet.
Right.
Lined up everything else accordingly.
That's right. There's the TV. Here's the sofa opposite it, which is not which then means that the TV has to get larger and larger and larger so that you can see it from the sofa because the living room got larger.
And everything you're saying is totally true, and it comes into a crashing conflict with the prime directive we spoke about earlier, which is as people more desperately, and it has taken the form of desperation for some of my clients, more desperately want to be connected to the outdoor world when the sun is out. When the sun is down, if your furniture is facing a view, it's very hard to face a view and a fireplace and a TV set and a kitchen where you're cooking.
Mm-hmm.
So you have this bizarre sort of multi-focused look at things in a space that is shrunken from the great room scale. And it becomes very interesting that each window opening and each place where you sit is carefully, carefully calculated so that it's either extremely flexible and thus is detached from the wall, or it's literally built into the wall because there isn't enough space to have a freestanding piece of furniture.
Mm-hmm.
So we're finding spaces that are smaller and more completely designed with furniture that's, when it's freestanding, is more flexible because people really do want to participate in the outside of the world, and people also really do love the idea of watching really great televisions with wonderful images on them, and they want to have direct human personal contact when people are cooking because people like to cook with other people with them. And and this is all sort of the wonderful soup of homes, is that these conflicting, contrasting, elaborating human desires end up working themselves out only partially in each home, and they get more evolved and more changed as each family expresses itself where they live differently. And that's why I've loved doing what I do for about 30 years. So
yeah,
that's why I think houses are great.
We have just a little bit of time in this episode, and I mean, this is really, there's just so many things to talk about. How did we ever end up with the vestigial bathtub-like bathtub in America, the 30 by 60 inch tub that is so shallow that you can't, and so short that you can't recline in it? I mean, this is one of the things I love about traveling is you go to places where they have real bathtubs and, you know, real, I mean, the British are really good at plumbing. I guess it's because, you know, of Roman occupation 2,000 years ago. You know, turn on the taps in a British decent quality hotel, and it's not Niagara coming out. You go to any place in Italy, and a real bathtub is, gosh, you know, it's like hip high, you know. Mm-hmm. It's a real tub. Mm-hmm. And you can stretch out and you can soak, and the American bathtub is useless for anything. Well, it's not even useful for bathing babies in, because it's the wrong shape. How do we end up like that? What do you think?
Oh, it's very simple. When the advent of the shower happened, people wanted to get in and out of the shower and still have a tub, so the sidewall of the tub got dramatically lower so you could actually use the tub as a shower. And so you had a terrible shower and a terrible tub.
Yeah.
Which is why you end up having now no tub and a great shower in more and more homes, and we've got one nice baby tub somewhere and no gigantic tub. Or you've got a tub and a shower separately. And mostly now it is there are soaking tubs being done because people like to soak.
Sure.
They don't like to wash. They like to wash in the shower and soak in the tub. So I think people are beginning to kind of get out of the hybridization of things and see, what do I really value, and spend more money on what they really value and less money on what they think other people value.
Mm. Which is good.
Yeah.
I also think it's very encouraging what you're saying about how the American family life is changing, because you have more adult children living at home or moving back home.
You bet.
You have aging parents perhaps coming back home. You have friends living together. And I'm not talking about, you know, a couple that's living together before or never getting married, but you have all these different scenarios for family life. And these types of features that you're describing handle them very well, I think.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, well, June Cleaver's gotten divorced. Is now her son's, you know, the Beeve has come back,
yeah.
And you know, mom is there with, you know, June's mom with Alzheimer's has moved in as well. So it's a very strange, unpredictable world.
Oh no, that's already been predicted. It was a TV series called Dallas.
Uh-huh.
There you go.
It's a compound.
And JR is dead. He actually is dead.
That's unfortunate. Yes, no one lives forever. I think we've come to the end of our allotted time. An hour goes by so quickly. But it really takes an hour to really get into any of these discussions. I thank you both very much. We've been talking with Duo Dickinson, architect, and Charlotte Barnard, writer and critic. We've been talking about home. So this is home part one. I hope to do many more conversations, and I hope that both of you will participate in the future. You've been wonderful guests. I thank you very much.
It's been a great pleasure.
Tell me in, Curtis. Great being with you.
Absolutely. This is Burning Down the House on Heritage Radio Network. I'm Curtis B. Wayne. Thank you for listening. Keep the faith.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.